Get your hat, leave your worry on the doorstep. Just direct your feet to the sunny side of the street. And you hear a better path and that happy tune.
It was hot that afternoon as we rolled out to Rocky's home in Henderson, Nevada, northeast of Las Vegas. The information on Rocky's home address came courtesy of Dex, who also told us he had his own crew around him. Narito gave Katz a contact number and told him to drop a dime when we knew where Susan was. Rocky's place was on a ranch estate, and at the gates we met a burly guy on a big horse who was carrying a Winchester rifle. His name was Philip Tolliver, a former Marine. A muscle for Rocky that John Ball would have met back in the service. After a bit of catching up, Tolliver agreed to us heading down to the main house and meeting up with Rocky, although we would only get 20 minutes of his valuable time. Yeah, I guess it's the paperwork that kills you when you're a professional night owl. Rocky was sat around the pool with four bodyguards watching on, and he didn't look in good shape. His nose was splinted and bandaged, as was his torso. We told him we were looking for Susan Wilton, and the immediate response told its own story. "She's trouble," he said, "and not just because she brought Bobby DeWitt and his crew to his door." Rocky's account of things went as follows. The previous Friday, Pierce Paget had called Rocky. They knew each other from the gambling circuit. He'd asked to come to the club on Saturday night with a friend. That friend turned out to be Susan Wilton. They played roulette, and everything was normal, until Susan and Pierce had an argument. After that, Pierce hit the bar and left the lady at the table. Rocky said that Pierce looked squirrely, and if he'd been allowed to, he would have drunk the place dry. Susan started winning, but her lucky streak turned out to be about 100 miles long. She won 16 spins in a row. Then she wanted to double or quit, with the stakes of 10 grand. Rocky, to his own surprise, agreed and okayed it. The ball behaved strangely. It moved through the air in an unnatural fashion. Rocky did pay her out in cash from his reserves, but it cleaned out the place. She apparently gave some of the money to Paget, then headed out to his car, insisting he drive her home. Pierce nervously obliged. Rocky then called Phil to track them down for a little friendly conversation. Phil followed them. They had a 10 to 15 minute start, but there aren't that many highways out of Rocky's desert casino. Suddenly, Susan appeared in the headlights, and Phil barely managed to avoid hitting her. Pierce had driven off and left her on the roadside. She claimed she had no recollection of her winnings. She had no cash on her, and she was behaving screwy. She got in the car, and Phil took her back to the casino. She was laughing all the time. This annoyed Rocky, who asked Phil to knock her about a bit and shut her up. Rocky then needed to inform people that they were down a substantial amount of cash. On Sunday afternoon, Bobby DeWitt showed up, claiming to have been sent from L.A. to have a conversation with both Rocky and Susan. Bobby assumed Susan was a cheater and bundled her into a car heading to Coyote Springs, the location of a Dragna safe house. Rocky assumed that she had to be dead, and Bobby left Rocky with a split nose and a broken rib for his troubles. Bobby apparently had four guys with him, all of whom were known to Eddie as being psychos. Frankie Vini, Joe Batteri, Louis Dante, and Bobby Caprini. On the way out, Tolliver told us there was a gas station and auto repair shop just off the highway next to the track that led down to the safe house. Michael called Narito, but he seemed unenthusiastic about his guys tangling with Dragna's guys. He said we would have to do it for ourselves, and reminded Michael that the clock was ticking for Connie and Izzy. We headed to Coyote Springs, but not before Roger had hit the sporting goods store and picked up a heavy rifle and zeroed in a scope. We arrived in the environs of Coyote Springs in the early evening. Dragna's safe house nestled beneath a set of hills, and a one-track road ran above it. It was about a mile and a half away from the house. Roger reminded of his wartime role as a recon scout. We dropped him off and agreed to rendezvous back off the highway about 2 hours before midnight. Whilst Roger headed off on a recce, we hunkered down off the road and watched as the winds picked up and a storm began to brew out in the desert. Bits of scrub, bush, and Joshua tree flew past us, and a sandstorm appeared on the horizon. Soon we were all engulfed. Roger rejoined us as visibility dropped down to maybe 7 feet. After a while, the storm moved on, but Michael had the impression that the storm was moving in a circular pattern and getting closer and closer to the house. We approached the auto garage off the highway and knocked on the door, but there was no answer. Roger said that further on down the track, there was a workshop, so we headed there and knocked on that door. A young man opened the door. His father went for a gun. John Baldwin shot him dead. The now subdued young man provided us with information. He told us that there were 5 armed men in the house who had arrived in 2 cars earlier on that day, and they had a woman with them. We approached the house as stealthily as we could when we heard a blood-curdling scream. There was a pistol shot, followed by shouting and screaming. We moved swiftly to the front door to find it ajar. Inside, Frankie Vini was in the parlor, pointing his gun towards the dining room and shouting, "No, no, no." Taking no chances, John shot him twice in the legs, and he went down and laid still. The door to the dining room opened, and Joe Bateri staggered out. He was trying to hold in his intestines, which were bulging out of a wide red wound. Something large, with a long red clawed hand, moved behind him. It was horrible. A strange, shambling melange of insect and ape, and yet neither one nor the other. It sported a strange, wide-toothed smile from a head that looked like it had been fashioned from clay. It touched Joe, and they both just disappeared. Then 2 sand pillars suddenly whirled in from outside and changed into vaguely humanoid shapes. They reminded me of chimpanzees at the zoo, except they were made of sand. Eddie shot one and disintegrated. The second engulfed Roger, and he began to cough and choke as he began to drown in sand. Bobby DeWitt appeared suddenly in the window in the back of the parlor and fired into the room with his Thompson. We hit the deck. His shots caught the sand thing, which collapsed into a pile of sand. Louis Dante ran in from the kitchen screaming that she's coming, and then spontaneously combusted. He just went up in flames, staggered about as far as the porch door before collapsing in a smoldering heap. The last of DeWitt's crew, little Bobby Caprini, ran outside and was suddenly snatched up by a ropey mass of what looked like snakes. He was there, and then he was gone. The parlor was catching a light at this stage. Curtains were on fire and flames were licking up the walls. I told everyone to get out, and Roger and Michael were quick to respond. John Baldwin was on his knees, leaning over an armchair, and that's when I saw it. It was Eddie Bellows. He was bleeding out from a neck wound and choking in his own blood. John and I watched as his eyes went glassy and the poor kid passed to the next world. "DeWitt," Baldwin said. Then, from the kitchen, Susan Wilton appeared, wearing just her underwear. She was untouched by the fire, but bleeding from what looked like knife slice wounds. No doubt more of DeWitt's handiwork. She told us to leave, and we escorted her out of the house. The Japanese car screamed down the track, and Arito's Yakuza pals leapt out. He ordered Susan to get into his car, but she laughed and raised her hands above her head to the dark, stormy sky. I will confess, I did not exactly see what happened next, as she told us all to look away. I saw things boil from the sky, black, tentacled, ropey things, each the size of a truck, descended on the Yak's vehicles. Naruto blazed away with his Tommy gun, and I heard a loud screech. Then his vehicle roared away with the things in tow. Susan Wilton smiled at us and said, "My finest hour." Then her eyelids fluttered. She said no, and promptly collapsed. We were left, alone in the dark, with the house behind us being swiftly devoured by fire.